presented it. Imam said, you refer to fuqaha, to those scholars who are expert in understanding Islam. When we say fuqaha, we don't mean just fiqh. Fuqaha means those who are scholar in different disciplines and different areas.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if even they came or they tend to go to deviation,
right,
it's the duty and responsibility of Imam to provide the correct and right answer directly or indirectly.
Right.
So this is also...
So the 11th Imam actually had a lot of important tasks. First of all, he had to clarify to the people that these people who are claiming to be the final Imam, they're not the real Imams. The one is my son, Muhammad Al-Mahdi.
And it's not a matter of age.
Mm-hmm. And he's a young boy. He's only 5 years old, but he's capable of providing you the answers. And third of all, he prepared people for the concept that there can be an imam, but you have to use him like the sun behind the clouds, as we know it in the narrations.
And also, one more. I'm just cutting your talk. One very important discussion that Imam was very careful, because there were two companions of Imam, Hisham ibn Hakam and Hisham ibn Salim. They were talking about the essence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to go to realize that the essence could be something material. So Imam started talking and said, no, don't talk about the essence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because you go by wrong discussions that you may go astray and fall outside of Islam. So the denial of materiality from the essence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and also the necessity and significance of imamate and the characteristics,
the features of the imam.
Right.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shamili. I really appreciate your presence here in the program today. Thank you, dear listeners. We are going to say goodbye to our honorable guests, but don't go away. We'll be right back.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. O Allah, be for your representative, the Hujjah, son of Al-Hasan. Your blessings be on him and his forefathers, in this hour and in every hour, a guardian, a protector, a leader, a helper, a proof, and an eye, until you make him live on the earth in obedience to you and cause him to live in it for a long time.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Shamili, for your time and for your effort. I really enjoyed listening to today's discussion. It was very informative. I hope that our dear listeners also enjoyed this discussion. We hope to have you in our upcoming shows, inshallah.
Thank you and all listeners, and I wish all the best of luck. Thank you.
Until another episode of The Ship of Salvation, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Good evening to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. We start off this hour's program with Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all, along with a brief explanation about the hadith. Next up will be our varied radio productions feature, and we finish off this hour's programs with Muslim Lady, the quintessential radio program for Muslim women. The program is hosted by Muslim women and deals with a variety of subjects all related to women.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, salam and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today, we begin by offering our heartfelt congratulations to all lovers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam on the blessed birth anniversary of Imam Hassan al-Askari, peace be upon him. A man of deep wisdom, purity, and insight, the Imam of the followers of Islam, of followers of beauty and truth. And what a perfect moment to reflect on one of his most powerful teachings. Let me ask you a question first. What does it mean to work hard in the eyes of God, to pray all night, to fast constantly, or to memorize volumes of knowledge? Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam gives us a surprising answer. The most hardworking person is the one who abandons sins. It doesn't say the one who does the most worship. It says the one who stops sinning. But here is a problem. Many of us don't even recognize some of our worst sins. We've come to think sin is only about what's obvious: drinking, stealing, cheating. Of course, these are very, very, you know, huge sins. But what about laughing at someone's accent, belittling someone because of their skin color or their job, assuming someone is less because of where they're from? Racism, classism, arrogance, these are sins too, deadly ones. The Quran says, do not mock one another, perhaps they are better than you. Yet how many times have we rolled our eyes at someone who didn't speak our language properly, or used a word like they're backward, or those people. Sometimes we proudly avoid the sins we were taught as children, but we silently carry sins society has normalized. We lie without shame. We backbite under the excuse of just being honest. We make fun of someone's clothes, their poverty, their trauma, and never realize that may be the sin that drowns us. In fact, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, the worst sin is the one the sinner takes lightly. So if the hardest struggle is to abandon sin, then the first step is this. We have to recognize what sin really is, not just in law books, but in our hearts. So here are three practical ways to start. Daily sin scan. At the end of each day, ask, did I hurt someone today? Did I judge? Did I stay silent when I should have spoken? Even small wrongs add up. And learn what God hates. read the Quran with open eyes. Many sins are mentioned in the heart. Arrogance, envy, mockery, not just physical acts. And don't let culture excuse cruelty. If your friends laugh at someone's ethnicity or poverty or insult them, don't join in. Do not just try to fit in and be like others. You may lose a laugh, but you'll protect your soul. Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
September 23rd, the day Donald Trump showed up at the United Nations for yet another anti-Iran speech. But before he even reached the podium, the mishaps began. An escalator out of service, a teleprompter on the blink.
And I don't mind making this speech without a teleprompter, because the teleprompter is not working.
The only surprise? That the American president didn't find a way to blame Iran for it. As the former reality TV star and current American president delivered his trademark mix of spectacle and unverified claims, something else was happening.
Step it up. I can't be doing so.
In the capital city of Tehran, Iranian state television aired a recorded speech from the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The contrast could not have been sharper. A carnival of rhetoric on one side and on the other. An appeal to facts, strategy, and self-determination. Ayatollah Khamenei's message carried weight both at home and abroad. Chief among his points, Iran will never abandon its nuclear enrichment program. But the leader also made clear once again that nuclear weapons are not on Iran's agenda. Instead, enrichment is as a strategic resource. Fueling clean energy, advanced medicine, food security, and cutting-edge research. A technology that turns Iran's abundant natural uranium into national power, economic independence, and scientific prestige. Tehran sees enrichment at 60% not as a military step, but as proof of scientific maturity, resilience, and sovereignty. The assassinations of top Iranian scientists, the sanctions, the pressure, none of it has stopped Iran from training thousands of experts and climbing into the ranks of the few nations with such advanced capability. Ayatollah Khamenei's position on Washington was equally blunt. Negotiating under threats, he said, means surrendering both strategically and morally. Iran has seen it all before. Promises broken even during the nuclear deal, sanctions weaponized as leverage, endless demands stretching from missiles to regional influence. For Tehran, talking to the United States has come to mean legitimizing pressure, not resolving it. What America calls dialogue, Iran views as coercion. And that, the leader of the revolution argued, is why Iran will not step back, because to do so would be to erase its dignity as a nation. Ayatollah Khamenei also pointed to something that the West rarely acknowledges: national unity. During Israel's attacks on Iran this summer, during the assassinations of commanders and scientists, Iranians did not fracture. Instead, they filled the streets, not in protest against their government, but in solidarity with it. A message of defiance, cohesion, and unmistakable resolve. The leader's bottom line? Strength. Real strength. Not through trust in adversaries, but through domestic resilience, national self-reliance, and unity. And that strength, he said, means advancing not just nuclear science, but every dimension of power, economic, cultural, and military. The very next day, Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian stepped onto the stage of the UN General Assembly. His tone was different, but his message aligned. He presented Iran not as an aggressor, but as a nation seeking peace, multilateral cooperation, and respect among equals, what the West seems uninterested in.
Last week, after 10 years of failed attempts to subdue the proud Iranian people through evasion and support for military aggression, three European countries acting on behalf of the United States sought to reinstate the Security Council resolutions against Iran that had been revoked. They did this through pressure, threats, and blatant exploitation. By doing so, these countries abandoned good faith, circumvented legal requirements, and misrepresented Iran's legitimate compensatory measures in response to the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, as well as Europe's total disengagement and ineffectiveness as serious violations. They presented themselves as the parties to the agreement in good faith and rejected Iran's sincere efforts.
The Iranian president reminded the world that Iran opposes weapons of mass destruction, and he drew attention to what he called the real violence in today's world. The killing of children in Gaza, wars waged by Washington and its allies, the hypocrisy of those who call for negotiations while launching attacks.
Over the past 2 years, the world has witnessed genocide in Gaza. It's also seen destruction of homes, repeated violations of sovereignty and territorial integrity in Lebanon, the destruction of infrastructure in Syria, attacks on the Yemeni people, the forced starvation of children in the arms of their mothers, covert assaults on state sovereignty, violations of territorial integrity, and blatant targeting of state leaders, all with the full support of the world's most heavily armed government under the pretext of self-defense.
And while rejecting Western betrayal in past agreements, President Pezeshkian extended Iran's hand to neighbors and partners. His message: Iran does not need America to thrive. Trade, innovation, diplomacy, and security can all be built through regional and global partnerships that don't rely on Washington's approval. The Iranian president said that what the US and Israel did to the Iranian nation in the so-called 12-day war was a betrayal of diplomacy, a blow to international trust, and a massacre against humanity.
Ali janaban, khanum ha va aqayan.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have all witnessed a brutal attack on my country last June. This attack violated the established principles of international law. While diplomatic negotiations were ongoing, the Zionist regime and the United States launched airstrikes on Iranian cities, homes, and infrastructure. This betrayed diplomacy and undermined efforts to establish stability and peace. In addition to killing Iranian leaders, civilians, women, children, scientists, and academics, this blatant aggression dealt a blow to international trust
and the prospects of regional peace. The massacre of children, babies, and women is one of the things you can learn from this crime and carnage. This is a book about the massacre committed by Israel against men, women, and children in our country. It is a massacre against humanity.
Two speeches, two voices, back to back from Iran's leader of the revolution and its president. They laid out the same doctrine, a foreign policy rooted in dignity, prudence, and national interest. A strategy that welcomes friendship but also warns any hostile act will meet a firm response.
Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
I know I'm waiting, yearning for something, something known only. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong. We'll be right back.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, my dear sisters. We are all walking on the same road. Sometimes stumbling, sometimes carrying heavy loads. But all the times, the strength of women and ladies is the thing that everybody would talk about. This program is not me talking to you, but us walking together, learning from each other's steps. So let's begin this journey side by side. Wherever you are, I hope you're doing well. And this is once more Asma, who's got the honor to be your host in here. And with me, I have a very, very dear guest, Sister Mahdiya. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me. Sister Asma.
Thank you for coming here, first of all. And second of all, we have a ritual in here. Whoever who comes gives us a very brief introduction about themselves and their field of studies and their background.
Okay, so I've come from originally from England, but lived in Central Africa for quite a few number of years. And then I've recently moved to Qom, enjoying it a lot.
When it comes to marriage, there are many questions, many challenging questions that might pop up in the mind of the girl that is about to get married. And why we're addressing only women, because obviously this is the ladies' corner, and that's why we're here. We are here to bring into light whatever that is important for all the ladies out there. And specifically, today's discussion is going to be on high expectations. Now, the question is, are high expectations in marriage a sign of love and care or a silent poison that leads to disappointment? How can I understand that what I have in mind is high expectation and it's not? Because most of the time it's like this, that whatever standard I have in my mind, that looks to me very normal. And I don't get that it's high expectation.
Yeah, try it out and you'll get it. You try it out and then you see the reaction. That's the only way. Going beyond what's normal, mm-hmm. That's a high expectation. Just be normal. Just don't expect too much, you know.
Yeah.
So you get into a marriage and then you start demanding, as in, you know, I want this, I want that. You know, you have a house, you've got a nice bedroom and lovely furniture and everything is comfortable. They've provided, the family's provided everything. Then you go for more and more. So right from the beginning, when you go into a marriage, you have to have that in mind, that whatever I get, I'll be content.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Islam is all about. If you're a practicing Muslim, then you will, like we say, the nice, basic. You get all the basic necessities, then why would you go for more? But then when you get married and you realize, but I'm sure you've spoken to your future husband about your living conditions and
exactly
what he's going to provide and all that. And then still, when you go into the marriage, when you get there to his home, you're not going to immediately ask, you know, and you, if you're going to be a practicing Muslim, you're just going to accept what it is. And then slowly, maybe if you see how his work, if he's able to, then you would ask. But going, you know, from one, like going to an extreme, I would say.
From the very beginning.
Yes, from the very beginning, it's very negative. One wouldn't, shouldn't do that. So take it slowly. Check out, you know, suss out your husband, what he's like, what his work, you already know what he's like, what his work's like. But then now you're living together, just
know
out
more about each other's perspective.
Before, yeah, and then probably ask him, but then, yeah, and again, don't demand. Remember, marriage is not about demanding anything. It's about working and asking and seeing if it's available or possible, yeah.
When we talk of marriage, that means you've got enough of maturity. Supposedly, you're mature enough now to understand and realize that not everybody is just like the same or the same way that you want them to be. No, the concept of variety and different colors and different shades of personalities must be a thing that you actually have acknowledged before marriage, because that's very important. Now, as the code I mentioned before the break, it was to accept your partner's change mm-hmm. and all the things that might entail. Like the idea that how it would relate to today's discussion is that just by getting married, you come to accept that, okay, whatever the condition is, be it sadness, be it happiness, I'm there. And this in itself, I guess, would reduce the amount of expectations yes. you would have from the other person. Very true.
A stressed husband is not a nice husband, believe
exactly.
me. Exactly. So you want to keep it to certain limits.
Don't you think that having this bond and friendly connection to each other would reduce the amount of expectations?
And also that bond that you create with your husband without asking for anything,
mm-hmm.
without expecting anything, automatically will make him, you know, give you what you haven't even voiced yet.
Would make a giving being out of him.
It'll be, yeah, exactly. And it'll be done out of such love.
Yes.
So imagine demanding something and then having, he's not wrath, but his unhappiness, rather than just being so loving and bonding with him and then him giving it to you out of his own free will.
Exactly.
Is such... Such
it's
joy.
More beautiful.
Well, yeah, there's joy in that. You know, you feel so good inside
yeah.
you. You know? So just, again, patience and just be tolerant with whatever and it'll come your way. Always start slowly. Don't rush into it. You've met someone. You've just got into a new life. Take it slowly. Take it a step at a time. Don't rush into things. And it really works that way. Believe me, I have experienced this. You know, you don't rush into anything. If you take things slowly and if you respect your partner, it'll all fall into place.
Mm-hmm.
That's my advice. I would really, say that it works. You know, never, never rush into things. Never be impatient. Always, you know, and you see that...
And women have got their own strategies. They
yes,
know that.
Yes, yes. Oh, they know how to wrap the
yeah.
man. And wrapping a man around your little finger is going about it slowly.
Yeah.
And with
so
understanding.
See,
yeah.
That's a lesson you have to take very seriously.
Very slowly, yeah.
So, now when we talk about this balance mm-hmm. to create it, and then we all know that women know how to do it, there comes a condition when the spouse would not understand you. How would you deal with that?
Yeah.
Like they would take that as really being expecting too much.
As in when you've taken it slowly and
yeah.
then he's still not understanding.
Yes.
He's still and okay, and then you're at the end of your tether.
Exactly.
You're like,
yeah.
That's it. He's just not getting it, you know.
I've got enough.
I've done enough and he's still
and
not getting
enough's
it.
And enough.
So what would you do? Talk to his mother? No, you wouldn't do that. Not a good idea. Yeah, so just straighten
or maybe
out it out.
Fight
you know?
With him.
Not fight, but take it out. Yeah, take it up with him now, seriously, you know. What, you wouldn't say, oh, look, I've been nice to you all this time and you're
mm-hmm.
still not getting me, you know. Just talk it out with him and say, look, this is what I want. Then you would, again,
yeah.
Talking out is a good thing,
mm-hmm.
but again, not demanding. Always very calmly, sweetly, in a nice way.
Exactly.
And results are really good when you're doing it in a nice way. Rather than really being vulgar and, in a harsh way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than that, just very calmly tell him, look, I really, really want this. And please, would you? And then reason it out. You know, if you give out real concrete reasons, there's no man who wouldn't understand.
And he's not a stone, I guess.
Obviously.
He will get
yep.
touched
yep.
by whatever
yep.
you're going to
And by
share.
That time, he's already... You've already built that love, so now he's going to say, oh, yeah, so I didn't figure this out. Okay, so now you're talking it to him, and he's figuring it out. So he needed it to be put into words.
Yeah.
So your gestures were not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Now that your words are out, he'll probably understand, but in a nice way. You'll have to talk it.
Exactly. So I do believe that being a demanding person is not a virtue, and
no.
nobody would love to be a demanding personality mm-hmm. because that would reduce from who you actually are.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go for a break and then we'll come back to see if there's any good in expecting more.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
back. You're listening to Muslim Lady. I'm Asma, and Sister Mahdi is in here with me, and we're having a quite interesting discussion about high standards and being too demanding and having high expectations in a marital life. So when the phrase marital life comes there, it in itself would have this connotations of maturity, would have this connotations of compromise, of trying to be so understanding and relate to the other side's problems and perhaps issues, because you do not know, no matter how much you love your husband, but there are some sides and I guess corners of him that you do not know. Maybe they have some problems, they're suffering all alone, and maybe there are things they cannot share with you. So always pushing them into a direction that is going to add to their stress is not going to do you any good. No. But then there's another thing that I would love to add at the very last part of today's episode of Muslim Lady, and that is about growth that comes out of expectations.
Depends what kind of expectations you have. And mm-hmm. Yes, you grow, you become more productive, there are better results in marriage. So yes.
And it gives you a driving force, I guess.
If you get to those expectations that you have, and yes, it'll make you grow, make you more mature, and you'll be more productive in your life. You'll be more productive. So we can say that, yes, some expectations work towards that. You know, they exactly. drive you into becoming a better person. Mm-hmm. And so the opposite person should understand this, that while I'm asking or while I'm wanting more, it's because for the good of both.
Yeah.
Both the spouses.
And I guess it's not just about asking something. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to actually share your support. You have to say that I'm going to back you up in this.
Exactly.
And you're not alone. Yeah. And it's not just something that I want for myself. Yeah. It's for the benefit of both of us.
So if you have a partner that mm-hmm. actually does that's a plus. You know, you want to do something and you want him to back you, support you. So that's a plus point. And you have to say it out. For some spouses, men don't understand this. And they don't know that for you to grow and be productive and be a much more better person, you need that push mm-hmm. and that, you know, to be allowed to do that, what you want to do. So they need your backup. So sometimes you need to tell them this. It's always good to talk about it.
Exactly. You know? And we have also role models.
We have. In Islam, we have, obviously, Bibi Zahra and Imam Ali, and Bibi Khadija, why not?
Yeah, exactly. She actually gave prophet. Everything that she had in order for the Prophet to actually to pave the road for his mission.
Yeah. So we do have role models, and we just need to find them, seek them out, and then study them, and then follow them. So they're back in those days, but still, they still apply to us now. They're there for us, and we can use their examples and in our lives now. Look, take everything very slowly, very calmly. Be mature about it. Don't let anybody interfere in your lives. Don't let your friend or your mother or someone tell you, right, you're now, you know, you're married, okay, ask for this and do that. No, sort it out yourself. Figure it out yourself. You're the one living in that family. You're the one sharing your life with that man. So you know him best. So my advice would be not to take anyone's advice or, you know, ideas, and just figure it out yourself and take it calmly.
Because you know the conditions.
Exactly.
You're the one who's in the game. Yeah.
So take it calmly and don't.
Yeah.
Because people might give you a negative mm-hmm. advice. You don't know it's negative, but they will tell you, you know what? No, why don't you ask for this or do that? And that's not really good. So
exactly.
If somebody were to tell you, just don't ask me, go for it. You sort it out. That's the best advice anybody can give. You know, because you're living it, you sort it out.
It's your story. You have to write it down.
Be mature about it. Yeah.
And be mature. Yeah. So I would end it this way, that with all the virtues that we might add to expectations, or say that, yes, with expectations we're going to grow and we're going to develop a better version of ourselves. But then I love this quote that says, expectation is a slavery, but contentment is a treasure that not everybody has. So this is the teaching of our Islamic heritage, and we have to take it very seriously. So try to work on contentment in your heart, because that's a real treasure. This was all for today's episode. I hope you have enjoyed that, dear ladies. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Good night to all of our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. In total, 25 prophets are mentioned in the Holy Quran in different chapters. Prophet Moses, or Musa in Arabic, peace be upon him, is mentioned 136 times in the Holy Quran, making him the most mentioned prophet of all in the Holy Book of Allah. The literal meaning of the word Quran is the which is being read. The word Quran is repeated 70 times in the Book of Allah itself. The month of Ramadan is the only month of the year mentioned in Quran in verse 185 of chapter Al-Baqarah, or second chapter. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. We'll start off this hour's programs with Black and White. The program covers the latest developments in Latin America and tells you what is happening in this strategically important region. After that, we have Islamic Laws. The program focuses on Islamic laws and adopts a practical approach to the subject. Next up will be our varied radio productions feature again. Stay with us for this hour.
Black and White.
Today we conclude our fourth season in Black and White. There are over 100 episodes dedicated to the fight for freedom, sovereignty, peace, and the development of nations. To the struggle against imperialism and Zionism. To the fight for the existence of the Palestinian people, which is under severe threat. To the battle for peace that has been disrupted.
Del pueblo palestino que está absolutamente amenazada, a la lucha por la paz que está quebrantada.
We invite you to a summary of our best programs.
De nuestros mejores programas.
However, we must acknowledge that those who reject them are precisely the ones who possess these weapons of mass destruction. It's clear that the Zionist entity has a nuclear arsenal, and the United States, by the way, has used it to devastate the entire planet. This has been the only instance where it's been used against civilians and communities. Yet there's also no element here to hinder scientific and technical development, medicine, or ultimately the sovereignty and economy of a country. Nowadays, atomic energy is primarily utilized to generate electricity that is completely non-polluting.
No, evidentemente la energía nuclear es una energía limpia.
Clearly, nuclear energy is a clean energy source that has been heavily criticized, especially in Europe, particularly after the Fukushima disaster. However, overall, nuclear energy is a safe and clean energy option within certain parameters. Therefore, there is no reason to reject the idea of countries turning to nuclear energy to enhance their energy self-sufficiency. For instance, in Iran, a country that relies on fossil fuels for energy generation, given that it is a significant producer, the Islamic Republic wants to diversify their energy sources. Additionally, nuclear energy has applications in medicine and various scientific developments that benefit the entire community, not just for military or energy purposes. Thus, there are numerous potential uses for nuclear energy. With the experience of the Israeli aggression against Iran, it also has every right not to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. In fact, even the week before the attack, Iranian hackers discovered that the agency was collaborating with the Zionist entity, or rather the Zionist entity was providing information to the agency to accuse Iran of developing a nuclear program. Therefore, if the agency is not an objective overseer of Iran's nuclear capabilities, Iran has every right to distrust the agency and any cooperation in that regard.
And also, this is just my personal opinion. As you mentioned, Iran has every right to possess a deterrent weapon against the nuclear arsenal of the Zionist entity of Israel and the United States, as well as England. Let's not forget that back in 1953, they orchestrated a coup due to the nationalization of oil during those years, long before the revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In other words, the interventionist nature aimed at hindering the independent and sovereign development of the Persian nation has been a historical fact. It's not that the West today is merely focused on this.
Exactly. Consider the issue of nuclear energy. The Israeli regime is an entity that does not comply with or is not open to any international inspections, and it possesses nuclear weapons. It is the only country in the West Asia with nuclear arms, which it uses as a guarantee that its aggressions always go unpunished and can even reach the point of attacking other sovereign nations. So, one might say, well, we have the case of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which has developed nuclear weapons as a guarantee that sovereignty will not be violated by any other state. Therefore, it's not that we should demonize this. Rather, we need to understand that fundamentally, nuclear weapons are generally deterrents. Nuclear weapons are developed not to be used. One might think, well, you create a weapon to use it, but statistics show that nuclear weapons are actually deterrents. There's a professor, an American academic, John Mearsheimer, who stated that the best guarantee for peace in the West Asia is for Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. This is the strongest assurance that they won't be attacked so openly. However, Iran possesses other capabilities that, for instance, the United States does not have. Hypersonic missiles are a technology that currently only three countries possess: China, Russia, and Iran. In this context, we must consider what options Iran might also rightfully pursue.
Iran has made the choice not to have weapons, and it says so publicly, even from a religious perspective. What do you think about that?
Of course, there is a fatwa from Ayatollah Khamenei that explicitly condemns the use of weapons of mass destruction. Iran will not develop weapons of mass destruction because it contradicts, let's say, the ethical and moral principles of the Iranian Revolutionary Project. In fact, there is an ongoing discussion in Iran today about whether dissidence should be reconsidered. It is a discussion that Iranian society itself is also rethinking in light of the recent events.
Está repensando a la luz de lo que ocurrió.
Así es. Ahora, ¿es posible?
That's right. Is it possible to achieve peace and stop accusing Iran of everything while the war, the colonization of Palestine, continues?
La colonización de Palestina.
I believe that, honestly, I think it's impossible. The main reason or focal point of original instability is not the Islamic Republic of Iran or other factors, but rather the Israeli regime. The Israeli regime, and we are witnessing this today, is something I believe is clear to everyone. There's no need to keep pretending or acting as if things aren't what they are. The major disruptive element in the West Asia region is the Israeli regime, which is currently engaged in this project to create the land of Israel. the greater Israel, aiming to occupy Syria and even expand into Jordan and Egypt. This is a situation that is very much present, and it represents the greatest threat to regional instability.
Dear Carlos, we say that this period has been the most brutal, or one of the most brutal, in the genocide of these 77 years. How can we explain this and the use of the most modern warfare technology against the most militarily primitive nation of Palestine?
Tú estabas hablando de la inteligencia artificial y me parece excelente.
You were talking about artificial intelligence, and I think that's a great point. It shows that the massacre happening against our Palestinian brothers is not limited to just collateral damages and destruction. It is simply and cruelly a deliberately designed attack, meaning it is completely planned. We see this in every single attack, and we're also witnessing it now in this attempt, as they say, to distribute food, because there will be facial recognition of every Palestinian who tries to come and take a piece of food. And the other thing I also think is worth highlighting is that as a consequence of these last 600 days of massacre or more, the corresponding software sold for facial recognition is something that Israel constantly sells. And it shamelessly states that the surveillance software it sells to different countries has been previously tested, and we already know on whom it has been tested, the Palestinian people.
¿Con quién ha sido testeado? Con el pueblo palestino.
Así es, la inteligencia artificial usada para los fines más condenables. Por ejemplo,
that's right. Here, artificial intelligence is actually being used for the most reprehensible purposes. For instance, the war there, the aggression, the massacre, Gaza seems to be a laboratory for the application of artificial intelligence on the Palestinian people, where Western powers, particularly the United States and the Israeli war machinery itself, testing from drones to facial recognition, identifying each individual and so on. But will this brutality be able to stop the resistance of the Palestinian people? It is a brutality that must be condemned at every level.
It seems that cruelty, and I say this with great sorrow, has become fashionable. We're witnessing it in a way that truly shocks and hurts, this attempt to normalize cruelty. To what extent? Speaking from my perspective as a healthcare worker, as a doctor, regarding the indiscriminate bombing of hospitals, ambulances, and patients, with over 1,400 healthcare workers having been killed, this normalization of cruelty cannot be accepted. We cannot allow it to reach such extremes. You were talking at the beginning about the Freedom Flotilla. I just returned from Malta a few days ago. There, this initiative, this action by the civilian population, is in response to the silence of Western governments regarding the blockade that has long affected the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian people as a whole. The Freedom Flotilla has seen many attempts. One notable effort was in 2010 with the Mavi Marmara, which ended tragically with the killing of 10 crew members on that ship, which was trying to deliver emergency supplies to the Gaza Strip. This latest attempt by the flotilla, which was anchored in international waters just a few kilometers off the coast of Malta, has been attacked by drones, as you mentioned at the start, showcasing one of the incredibly cruel uses of current technology. The ship was attacked, and its crew also left a significant impact while trying to extend their support to the Palestinian people, once again denouncing the blockade that Gaza is enduring. Unfortunately, that attempt has been sadly thwarted. The Freedom Flotilla, despite all efforts to prevent it from setting sail, will try again and again, because its goal is for civil society to speak out against the silence of Western governments.
comenzó hace mucho tiempo. O sea, por una parte tú dijiste...
This has been going on for a long time. You mentioned something very true. There is a crucial need for the labor of thousands of undocumented migrants in the United States to support various sectors of the economy.
50 million.
Exactamente.
Absolutely. Not only is the workforce highly skilled, but it is also the cheapest and most vulnerable, working in agriculture, transportation, and more. However, the blatant cruelty we witness today from this man has historical precedents, such as during Obama's administration, which saw a significant number of deportations and crackdowns on migrants.
Durante su periodo.
Ahora, Donald Trump ha echado mano a una...
Now, Donald Trump has invoked the Aliens Act of 1798 that allows him to declare foreign enemies, particularly those involved in attacks, and he has applied this to Venezuelans by labeling the Tren de Aragua as a terrorist entity.
Tren de Aragua como algo terrorista.
Bueno, primero que Trump es un migrante.